Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. The kids are back in school. I still have two of my five kids are in school. So one's in grade 8 and the other's in grade first day of high school at Strathcona High School. So
that's a big one.
Hockey season starting up soon. Both of them are both in minor hockey still. So who knows, might be the last year for both of them. We'll see about that. But that's another huge crunch on the horizon for me.
How many teams are you coaching?
I'll probably participate in coaching two of them. I'll probably be a co-coach, associate coach, head coach in that category. And I really love coaching hockey. And, you know, the two things you learn coaching minor hockey, Bruce, is to be a good coach, you need to really get great mentoring from better coaches than you are. Yeah. And the other great teacher, of course, is experience. Because every year that you coach, I think you get a little bit more adept at it. It's not an easy thing to do at all, but it's a tremendously rewarding thing. And I would recommend it to any parent whose children are involved in minor hockey. If they can get involved in coaching, they should do so.
Yeah, my son, he played minor hockey from basically Tom Thumb right through 3 years of midget. I'm just in the middle tiers, you know, but he loved it the whole time. And I was involved on and off as an assistant coach. You have to be able to skate to be able to be a head coach. Back in Newfoundland, we didn't have that many arenas that we were great skaters.
And you were a goalie, right?
And I was a goalie. I didn't have to skate to be a goalie back in the 30s when I was growing up.
Yeah, the 1830s, did they even have skates, Bruce? All right. Let's talk. Let's get on with the business of the day, Bruce, yeah, which is so Jay Woodcroft was on Oilers Now on Friday. It was a really interesting interview. He's obviously a really bright and passionate hockey man. And he was talking about, you know, McClellan talked at the end of the year, Oilers coach Todd McClellan talked at the end of the year about the need to look in the mirror and figure out what the heck went wrong. And boy, was I all in favor of that, because this was a team, when people looked at the team that that had been built last fall for the coming year, they saw a team that could challenge in the playoffs, maybe challenge for the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
And that's when they looked at the roster put together by Peter Chiarelli. That's what they were seeing. And that's not what happened when it actually came time, when this team got on the ice. And I thought there was lots of problems with player deployment. And on the power play was one of these big issues. So I was wondering what Woodcroft was going to say about this. And so let's go through. I wrote a blog post today about it, but I want to hear what you have to think about it. People can read that blog post. So the first thing he said, Bruce, was kind of interesting. He thought that one of the big issues was they didn't have enough power play opportunities, and they did have the lowest number of power play opportunities by any team since the NHL in 94-95 went to an 82-game season. And since they started recording this, at least on the official website, how many power plays a team gets, it's the second lowest that I could find. Atlanta had 2.38 power plays per game in 1977-78, and the Oilers had just 2.56 per game last year. And when we can to put that into context, the team with the most power plays last year, the Colorado Avs, had 3.61 power plays per game. So the Oilers had 2.56. They had one fewer power play per game, more than one fewer power play per game than the Avs. And you know the thing about it, Bruce, is I can't for the life of me. Like, I've watched hockey a long time. And in terms of drawing penalties, like what teams might do to draw penalties, I can't really think of, other than a team having absolutely unbelievable outstanding skill that causes other teams to cheat to stop them, I can't think of anything that would separate teams of similar ability and the number of power plays to get. And certainly the Avs and the Oilers from last year, those teams had they are very similar kinds of teams. And I can't figure out, Bruce, why one team would have one power play per game more than the other. Can you? Well,
Colorado had that, you know, that absolute speedster, Nathan MacKinnon, playing center on their first line, you know, and he carried the puck a whole lot, and he seemed to draw a whole lot of defenders to him, and the refs would, you know, I mean, it's just natural that a player like that should draw a lot of penalties, right? Oh, wait a minute. Oilers had Connor McDavid. He kind of fits that description too.
Kinda.
What the hell happened there? Like, it makes no sense whatsoever. And, you know, you mentioned the Atlanta Flames. I recently posted a comment in Low Tide's blog about the fact the Oilers had the fewest power plays of any team since the Oilers entered the league in 1979. Last year, that was the worst total of 938 team seasons, where I threw out the two, and you did it by per game. I just threw out the two lockout seasons. And of the other nine,
oh, I threw those seasons out too, Bruce. I didn't do them per game. I actually didn't do all that work.
Almost 1,000 seasons of teams, and the Oilers with Connor McDavid, I guess the fewest power plays like ever. Please,
what was up with that? What do you think? Okay, do you have any theory at all? Is it just chance?
It's actually because of you, David. You know, you wrote those two articles about the Oilers getting screwed in the playoffs versus Anaheim in the spring of 2017, and that sparked a lot of whining. For like, nobody was complaining until you raised it in your column that day, and then people just went crazy. So I figured the Leafs were saying, "Now you think you got screwed last year? We'll show you." Anyway, I don't know. I mean, if I sound like I'm ranting, I am, because I was incensed about this all last year. Like, I must have mentioned it in four or five different game day posts about how there was one stretch where the Oilers went, it was 17 straight games where they drew less than the league average number of power plays. They couldn't get a call to save their souls.
If you're of the hope that it's bound to get better, yes. I think one of the other teams that had the lowest power plays all time was the Atlanta Flames the next year.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not bound to get better. What's bound to happen is the Oilers are going to again stink, and it's going to be so horrible that the franchise is going to move like the Atlanta Flames to Calgary.
Well, yeah, I mean, because they had Connor McDavid on that team, right? Now, I'm thinking they had Guy Chouinard and Bobby McMillan.
Eric Vale.
Star players. Not exactly speedsters.
Willie Platt.
Yeah. Jesus.
They were a good team. So anyway, Bruce, he was their Milan Lucic man. Okay, so Woodcroft's theory was this. Okay, and it makes sense on the face of it. Like, you have so few power plays, you're having trouble anyway. So then you don't have time to get in sync on the power play. You're not out there enough. You can't get going. And this makes intuitive sense what he says. And if you do look last year at the teams that had the fewest power plays, there is a general kind of trend last year where the teams with the fewer power plays also had mediocre, weaker power plays. But there's some real exceptions to that. I mean, Toronto had the second fewest power plays, and they had the second best power play. And when you look, Bruce, I looked at the 10 teams since they measured this, how did they do? Like, they were out of sync too, presumably all the time. And five of them had better than league average power plays, and five of them had.
I think it's pretty random.
I think Jay was stretching. It probably felt that way. Like, that was a real feeling. And I'm sure when you're looking at it, like, man, we can never get apart. We're just out of sync. And it probably felt that way, but I don't think that's the best explanation for what went wrong in the power play.
When you play 10 straight games with two power plays, I guess it probably feels that way, especially then. But man, I mean, you could make the counter argument that the teams that are more successful on the power play actually get less time to practice it because they're only on the ice for 30 seconds instead of 2 minutes. I mean, there's lots of ways to parse it. I would say I would be surprised if there was really any sort of long-term connections with more power plays equals higher percentage. It certainly would mean more power play goals just because, you know, if you get 50 more power plays, you're probably going to put 8 or 10 more pucks in the net. But if you got your percentage, probably wouldn't be materially different.
Well, Bruce, when we look at the power play time on ice, when the Oilers had the fifth best power play in the league in 2016-17, they were on the ice for 383 power play minutes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Last year, when they had the worst, they were on the ice for 365 power play minutes.
Yeah.
So only 18 minutes, just negligible amount of difference in terms of power play time. So that's another thing that makes you think, well, that's probably. You know, they seem to be in sync in 2016-17 when they only had a few more minutes on the power play than they did last year. So again,
they had 20 more power play goals So I don't know exactly how many more power plays they had, but they had a lot more successful, i.e. short power plays. That's why they had about
60 more power plays, if I'm not mistaken. All right. So we're not buying that as a reasonable thing for what went wrong with the power play. So the second thing was this Woodcroft was saying, and he was pointing out that he seemed to be suggesting there was some bad luck. And this, I think when you look at the shooting percentage, this is borne out, but he was saying that when you look at how the Oilers did in terms of gaining the zone, advancing out of the defensive zone, moving up the ice, they were one of the best teams in the league. And when you look at things like shots and scoring chances, they were above league average in terms of the NHL and the power play last year. So he was arguing there was a lot of process things going right, but they didn't finish off very well. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, so I think that other people have pointed to the shooting percentage being low for the Oilers on that power play. But here's one thing that I would point out. We track scoring chances of the Cult of Hockey. We break them down into grade A and grade B scoring chances. On a per-minute basis, the Oilers did have slightly more chances overall last year than they did the year before. So last year when the power play was so bad, they had more, just a fraction more scoring chances than they did overall when the power play was good the year before. But there was a major difference, Bruce. And this was in the quality of the scoring chances. In the year when the Oilers were really good, they averaged 1.3 grade A scoring chances per two-minute power play, 1.3. Last year, when the power play was bad, they averaged 1.08. And to me, that's significant. That's a big difference in those numbers. They were not getting as many. They were not getting as many as the very best scoring chances. They weren't able to manufacture as many of them on a rate basis as they were the year before. And that's honestly what I kind of saw when I was watching. And if someone was asked me intuitively what I thought was the problem, was, well, they're not getting great scoring chances because they don't have anyone feeding the they're not getting one-timers off the half wall and as much. And that's your problem. You haven't figured out how to do that. You're taking more shots, but they're useless shots, a lot of them. So,
well, a lot of them were 60-footers from the point.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, they seem to be going low to high a lot last year and taking a lot of shots from the point. And I mean, Oscar Klefbom with his bad shoulder, for whatever reason, he was just bombing away for the first large part of the season, and none of those pucks was going in. I think he had one power play goal all year, Oscar Klefbom, and it was a fluke that bounced in off a guy's shin pads. And it was the plays down low, whatever, the other team was closing it down, whether they weren't respecting the point shot, whether the Oilers' system, and I got a couple thoughts on that, wasn't very effective. But I do know in 2016-17, the Oilers had three forwards with over 10 power play goals. And, of course, that was Dreisaitl, Letestu, and Lucic, I think 12, 11, 10. And last year, the guy that led the team had six power play goals, that being, again, Dreisaitl. But they had the frustration I had with the power play was that, first of all, not a frustration, but a real positive, was his zone entries were so good. I mean, McDavid is just unstoppable when he roars up the ice. And, you know, if two guys shadow over to take him, he's going to find somebody else on the fly on the other side of the ice, and they're going to gain the zone. And if one guy tries to shadow over to take him, forget it. He's not going to take him. So getting the zone was no problem. But then they would get in there, and it was felt to me like the Oilers system had McDavid tethered to the side wall on the right side. And he was doing this half wall stuff. And every once in a while, he worked the puck out about as far as the faceoff dot. And first of all, he would never shoot from there. And that bugged me, because I think once in a while, you got to change up and let flies, especially when you got a shot as good as his. You know, the odd one's going to go on the net, or you're going to create a rebound, or at minimum, you're going to make the other team respect that they can't just cover the passing lanes, that they got to, you got that other thing in your, and that, I'd like to think he's going to do more of that, but we'll see. I'd like to see them untether him from the boards and give him a little bit of leeway to create. I mean, he does all his best work on the move. Eh? He's an when he's flying in his zone. Now that's not a power play situation anyway, generally. So maybe he's not a natural power player to the degree that he's just a natural score off the rush guy.
Yeah, he's a full court player, not a half court player.
Just give him some leeway to skate around in the zone a little bit more and maybe take him off the sidewall. Maybe, I don't know, maybe put him on the left wall so you can use all those left-hand shots in the center of the ice with the one-timers.
I don't see him, Bruce, as a...
Draisaitl on the right wall and let McDavid be not your bumper, but be your rover. You know, I mean, there's lots of ideas there that surely they can use. And I taught Jay Woodcroft, for whatever reason, his ideas last year, they just, nothing was clicking. And I'm frankly happy. I'm happy Jay Woodcroft is coaching in Bakersfield. I think he's still got a future. But I'm very happy they brought in a whole new set of assistant coaches. And Manny Viveros, I think, taking on the power play, that has a lot of potential.
So when they had a good power play in 2016-17, they had 100 grade A shots off the half walls, off the left and the right circles. 100 grade A shots coming from players like Draisaitl and Letestu. Last year they had 71 from that same group of players. True. So a 30, you know, that's a massive decline. And they were just unable to get off good shots, one-timer shots from the half wall. They moved Draisaitl. Like, at one point, he was playing left point of all positions. It was just incredibly – he was your best, most dangerous half-wall shooter, and he was often in the bumper position and bumper shooter the year before, and they didn't – only by the end of the year did they figure that out. Letestu just seemed to have lost his shot overnight and his ability to get off that shot. And they never did find someone, you know, even though they could have tried Jesse Puljujärvi there in their lost season. They never even tried him out. So Bruce, it was, and I agree with you completely, McDavid and RNH, they shouldn't be on the half walls, I don't think, because they're not great shooters from there. I'd love to see those two guys roaming around, just causing havoc with Puljujärvi and Draisaitl on the half walls bombing away and someone at the point. And I don't necessarily think you have to have that big blob of a guy, Lucic or someone maroon like that in front of the net. Like, you can have a successful power play. There are successful power plays without that tactic, which rely more on movement and skill. And I'd like to see for a month, even the Oilers to try a movement and skill power play where McDavid and Nugent Hopkins are behind the net on the point in the slot in the bumper, and Puljujärvi and Draisaitl are keying up for shots, killing it with shots, and they have someone, Klefbom, you know, as kind of the defensive stopper and passer distributor at the point. I'd love to see that. I think we're talking about the same idea in terms of the power play.
Yes.
And to me, what went wrong with the power play, they had the wrong players on the ice, and they had the wrong ideas for the players on the ice. They were in the wrong spots on the ice if they had the right guy, and then often they had the wrong guy because they stuck with, unfortunately, Lucic and Letestu weren't fast enough to retrieve pucks, and they weren't good enough, fast enough to get off good shots. Neither of them, I don't think, should have been on the power play. I'm very skeptical about Lucic on the power play this year, honestly. I don't think he earned it, and I'd rather see them go with a skilled power play.
I certainly understand starting the season with them after what they had done the previous year, but after 20 or 25 games are going nowhere, maybe you should change something up. But it seemed like right up till they traded Letestu, and Lucic finally kind of got a diminished role down very late in the season. But even then, Puljujärvi, no sign of him on the first unit. They went with Strome. And I was puzzled, frankly, by a few things, and not just power play, but a few learning opportunities that were kind of wasted in a season that was clearly going nowhere by about January the 15th to not put JP on the power play as one example. And I mean, they did do some things, like they gave Ethan Bear a good look down the stretch, but there was so much more they could have done with young players. And I last year, I think the coaching staff as a whole had a very disappointing season.
We're in the same boat there, Bruce. Let's talk about the prospects now. And you know what? They replaced most of the coaches except for McClellan. So a price was paid on a certain through the coaching staff. And I that's what gives me hope is Viveros and Trent Yanni and other people moving in and Gullitson moving in as the assistant coaches.
And a new challenge for Todd McClellan. Like, yes. Instead of having the echo chamber, like, he's got a new staff. I mean, it's for him, this is, I think it's the biggest challenge of his career this season, to weave together all the new talented coaches that he's got in his room, including his own talent, and find the right mix of new and old. And I think because he had the same staff for 6 years, the last three in San Jose and three here, and I think they were just starting to maybe agree with one another too much about, well, Lucic is our man in front. We'll start there, and then we'll, you know.
Yeah, that's how you run a power play. You got to have that big. But they never had a big net front guy in San Jose, did they? They never had that equivalent Maroon Lucic player. Maybe they did. Maybe it was Ryan Klo
at times.
But you know, it seems to me, I remember a lot of their power plays with Thornton kind of dominating really down low in the corner and moving it to kind of Pavelski and Couture, players like that, and Marlowe moving through the slot and not having a guy screening the goalie. And you don't, so I think there's all kinds of things you can do. Listen, McClellan hasn't made the playoffs through the last 4 years, Bruce. No. Bloody rights.
He's got a huge challenge.
Four out of five. Like,
he's gone if they don't make him this.
And he's really loved by the media because he's a great talker, and you can see that he seems like an outstanding individual and a great leader of men, like really knows how to handle people, I think. And I can give him all those things, but the tactics were they just didn't make sense. And I do think he has a sweet tooth for veteran players. He sticks with them too long, and that's partly why Letestu and Lucic, you know, theoretically they were earning it somehow. I didn't see how they were earning it last year with their play at even strength, and he didn't go with Puljujärvi, but
hopefully they get it right. In front of the net, here's an idea for you. Puljujärvi. Dreisaitl.
Yeah, or Puljujärvi.
Try it.
Yeah, try Dreisaitl. You might not like it, but try it. All right,
he'd be great there. I mean, you know, he might be even better somewhere else, but I think he'd be pretty ideal in that role.
Yeah, well, like Thornton, that's what down low. Thornton was always down low on that power play in San Jose, as I recall. Okay, Bruce, let's talk about the wingers now. Sure. We're going through the prospects position by position, and we're going to put the wingers together today because there's not a ton of them to talk about, but there is some really good ones, Bruce. I mean, number two and three on our list are Kyler Yamamoto at two and Kirill Maximov at three. So some real talent there. Let's start near the more bottom of the list. That's Joe Gambardella. Mm-hmm. He is number 24. So we started kind of writing individual profiles at number 25, right, and Gambardella was number 24. He's a bit old. He's an older player, Bruce. He's December 93, so he'll be 25. Yeah. And that's not much of a prospect at that point. So he had an okay year last year in Bakersfield. He's going to be challenged for playing time this year. He's got to get 2 points every three games and really start to come up big as a player. You know, there are depth roles on the Oilers, and he does have a chance at getting one of those if he can really step up his game this year in Bakersfield. But that's why he's rated so lowly, because he's older and he didn't have great success at the AHL level last year. He was okay.
Yeah, he's got a fair bit of, he's got a fairly broad game, I think. There's a few things he can do. He's strong on the forecheck. You saw him more than me. Was he a penalty killer of note down there?
You know, he's kind of a Lander type again, another one of these Lander types, you know, gritty, smart, tries hard, not a great skater, not excellent skill. So that's, you know, maybe it's kind of a fourth line grinder in the NHL. He can make a go of it. He's not a bad AHL player. I could see him getting 40 or 50 points there this year, but which, you know, kind of puts you in the running for an NHL job. So we'll see.
You need guys like that at the AHL level.
Yeah.
And maybe he works his way up where he gets a call up at some point. But I think anybody who's in our top 25 at least has a fighting chance to see some games in the NHL.
Yeah. So
where he's at the bottom end of that, number 24.
Yeah. there's a big leap between him and, say, Graham McPhee, who's number 14 and is our next prospect. So McPhee is he on my list here? When's his birthday? I don't even have my on my list of wingers, but I think he's 20 this year, if I'm not mistaken.
He's a younger fellow, maybe 21, but he was just drafted relatively recently, and he's just working his way up into the college system. And he's a guy that, for those of us who got out to development camp, which included you and it included Matt Mozovich, and we all seemed to take a liking to that guy and how what he brought. Like, to me, he did something that caught my eye 4 days out of four. And usually it was just whether it was a drill and just the grinding nature of him or the, you know, you can see he's the son of an NHL player.
He's that Dave Lumley type, eh? Yeah. Kind of that somewhat skilled, really pesky, kind of dirty, gritty, nasty. He had a lot going on in his game. I really liked his game. Mm-hmm. And did he ever stand out in that 4-on-4 game that I saw? He really, I mean, of all the guys, like, you know, there's all these players out there and lots of them with fairly decent reputations, but he's right. The one that the dark horse that stood out as a, wow, this guy kind of, there's something about him that says NHL game. And it's that smarts, those hockey smarts, you know, where you can make a play, but he's dirty and he's aggressive. And a lot of NHL players have made a living with skilled, dirty and aggressive, Bruce.
Yeah. And I suggest he's probably more of a 5-on-5 player than a 4-on-4, but he did things to stand out. Now, you had him ranked highest of our group of five. You had him at number 11. And he went ranked between 11 and 18 on our group overall, averaged in at number 14. So a player to watch, but, you know, from a distance. He's drafted in college. He's probably at least 2 years away from turning pro. But there's hope there. So our number 11, Ostap Safin. There's a guy who's, we had him very tightly bunched between 10 and 13, the five of us. And there's lots of like in that player as well.
Huge. I saw him play. He got called up to Bakersfield, I think, for about 9 games at the end of the year, if I'm not mistaken, 9 or 10 games. And, you know, he really didn't look great. And he didn't look great, I didn't think, in that prospects game either. He has the ability. So he's 6'5", 191. Yep. He can really dangle with the puck. He can really move the puck. And he did that a couple times in the prospects games. And he did that a couple times in Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. But I've seen players like this before where they're not going to be bottom six guys. They've got to make it in the top six. And he wrote, the guy that comes to mind is, I think, Ryan Martindale. I think it was a second or a third round pick a few years ago. And again, he had real size and real skill, but he never really got it together, even at the AHL level. And so I'm not saying, you know, obviously Safin is his own individual. He's going to make his own mark. He played on a really bad team last year in the Quebec League. And I don't know if it's going to be any better this year. So
they got the top pick in the CHL import draft. They got the number one guy, and he's a guy that played in the Ivan Hlinka. I can't remember his name offhand. He's a Slovakian kid. And good chance he and Safin wind up playing on the same line, I think.
Well, maybe that'll help Safin a lot. I think Joe Valino started the year there.
CHL trade deadline had mid-season. All the weak teams trade their best players.
So he's got a lot of offensive talent. He could make it. I guess he's eligible even to play in the AHL this year, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it would be best for him to do that. I don't think he'd get a lot of playing time given the depth on the wing down there. Mm-hmm. So I think he should go back to the Q and see how he does. I mean, the guy can skate and handle the puck. He's got size, so there could be an NHL player there. But again, he's in that, like McPhee, you know, there's a possibility, but there's not a great possibility of him being an NHL player.
Because he was drafted out of Europe and he came into the CHL's import draft, which is always a few days after the NHL draft. And I'm sure they do it on that order for a reason. But because he came out of Europe drafted that way, even though he played in the CHL last year, he is exempt from that rule that says he would have to be returned to his CHL team. He could go back to, he could go down to the AHL. It is an option. I agree with you. I don't think it's the right option for that player. I think he's one that's going to need time to mature. There's no reason to rush him into his entry-level contract because it's probably going to take better part of those 3 years to cure him into a proper North American pro. He does have one thing he has in addition to the size and the decent hands is speed.
Yeah.
And that's one thing he showed at the prospects camp was when he got going wide, man, he was tough to rein in. Those defensemen, you know, with the size of the guy and the puck control and the speed he was going, he was very hard to angle off. And I mean, obviously these weren't NHL trained, tested defensemen that were working on the guy, but you could certainly see potential there if he could sort of harness that and bring it on an ongoing basis. You know, there's certainly potential for where he got picked, which was what, fourth round?
Yeah, 115th overall in the 2017 draft. Puljujärvi is 14 months older than Ostap Safin. Mm-hmm. All right. Next on our list, Bruce, is it
Tyler Benson?
Tyler Benson. So you wrote about him, Bruce. What do you think?
Well, he dropped down our rankings. We had him at number two last year, and number three the year before, and then this year he fell all the way to number eight. And I guess we're kind of all in a show me state. And last year I was expecting him to take a big step forward that really didn't happen. Like, he was healthy, which was number one on the list. Have a healthy season. And he did. So that's good. But his points per game, which was like 1.27 in his draft plus 1 year, it actually fell back a bit to 1.19. I was hoping he'd be like 1.5, 1.7 even, like up pushing the scoring leaders, at least in terms of points per game. But he wasn't really there. And I think he's still sort of, even though he was healthy enough to play all the games, I think he's still kind of getting stronger. And I expect him this year still to take a step. But as mentioned, he's in the show me territory. And I guess the best place for him to show us is probably Bakersfield. I think it's a long time since we had a talented young drafted forward who was so obviously ready to turn pro in the minors as opposed to being rushed right into the majors, even at age 18, like so many of the Oilers draft picks. Here's a guy that, you know, he needs some seasoning, but he's just 20 now.
It's nice that the Oilers have some pure skill wingers, you know, like in Yamamoto and Benson they drafted, as opposed to bigger guys with the second or, you know, the late first, second round picks, third round picks. Like, just go for the pure skill guys and see if they turn out, because that's what the Oilers really need at the NHL level right now, some pure skill guys to play with Dreisaitl and McDavid and Benson. So I saw him at the end of the year, Bruce. I think I saw him play some games on the internet in Bakersfield, and he looked really good. He has great on-ice vision. He can really pass the puck. He can really see players. He can hold players. He's not super fast. He's got a good shot. He's good with the puck. He can protect the puck. He works hard. So he's got to get stronger. Like, he's got to get to become a stronger, more agile, faster skater and increase his work rate a little bit, I'd say, even from where it's at. I'm not saying he doesn't work hard. He's got to get quicker to the puck. And that could come with more core strength and better health over time. But his NHL skill, and the one that really excites me, is that vision. He can really pass it. He's kind of like a Nugent Hopkins player without the agility that Nugent Hopkins has. Like, Nugent's such a fantastic skater at this point, and he's a really great passer of the puck. So when you think of all the skills Benson have, think of Nuge, but with needing to improve his skating to get to that level. And that's the kind of player that we have here.
Yeah, he's I saw him play live with Vancouver Giants last year in a game against the Oil Kings. And then I saw him at development camp, which, believe it or not, in his now draft plus three season, this was the first camp that he was actually ever healthy enough to attend. He missed two summer development camps and two training camps with a variety of aches and pains and what have you, bodily afflictions. And it was nice to see him at camp. He impresses me with his play along the boards. Like, he's really good sort of doing the egg beater stuff along the walls, digging pucks out and then digging them out with purpose, like finding the open man and putting the puck on his stick. Like you say, excellent passer. He sees the pass and he makes the pass. And you got to like that combination. And he's, I think he's clearly going to be a complimentary player, but there's no real, I don't think there's a ceiling on this guy yet. I mean, people say he's middle six or whatever. Well, we'll see who clicks with who, right?
So he didn't stand out much at the dev camp game, which was really all about skating mostly. That was a real, skill in skating, I guess. But he didn't stand out in that game, and neither actually did the next guy on our list, number three, Kirill Maximov. But Maximov, he's kind of a sniper. He's kind of a, pure sniper guy. But boy, did he ever step up in this last junior season, Bruce. His point scoring, let me see if I can find something here. It just took off.
38, 42, 80 points. Sorry, 34, 46, 80 points.
Oh, that's his 60. Progression.
Yeah. No, that's a goals, assists, points.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
He's been climbing up the progression steeper than that. Like, he really took off into the almost 1.3 points per game last year.
Yeah, 1.29.
That same Billy Morris Cup game that he didn't impress you. They had a stacked team, white against blue, and he was on the unstacked team who lost 5-2. And he scored both goals. And yes, it didn't look like he was doing much. I remember watching Brett Hull play, and it didn't seem like he was doing much either until you looked at the damn summary at the end of the game. And there he was, a couple of goals, right? And that was – Maximov impressed me much more earlier in camp with his more overall game. But even on that – in that one game where his team didn't have the puck probably that much, I got a couple of chances, and they were in the net.
Yes. It was – Sean –
boy, do we need a guy with a right-handed stick who's got a quick release. And there is a bun in the system in Kirill Maximov.
Sean Patrick Ryan, the Oil Knight, saw a lot of Maximov. And he really loves his player as a prospect. And when he lists his strengths, he says the strengths are his elite shot. Yeah. He looks and plays like a pro, and his work ethic and determination. And this guy just works, mm-hmm. and more works. He needs to work on his skating. Is his weakness, but yeah, he's one of these smart players, like the Camilleri class attacker, finds the sweet spot on the ice can just rifle that puck. So it's great that again, he was a low round draft pick. He was taken after Ostap Safin in that same draft. Mm-hmm. Yep. And if they can get a player out of him, oh, God, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've almost forgotten, David, what it's like to steal a guy in the middle rounds of the
draft. We have forgotten, Bruce. I have forgotten what that's like. I don't remember.
I remember Glenn Anderson in the fourth round and Jari Kurri in the fourth round. Pekkanen in the fourth round. And, but it's been a while. And if you look at the Oilers list, it's just been way too long. I think we ranted about this at a previous podcast, so I'll leave it there. Other than say Maximov is a guy who might break that mold. And he did enough to move all the way up from number 16 to number 3 in our rankings. And it was kind of a split. We had everybody's number 1, number 2 was the same. But the five of us had four different players listed as number 3. And it was a sort of a blanket vote for number 3. And he snuck in there in a tiebreaker. But anyway, it was he certainly worked his way into the conversation with an outstanding year, and nothing he did in that camp that made me think of any less of him.
Wonder if he can get like 1.5 or 1.6 points a year. It's possible, right? And yeah. I guess he could play for Team Russia at the World Juniors. I wonder if he's if they, it depends on their coach. Like sometimes those Russian coaches, they just want to go with players who stayed in Russia. They don't go very much with the players who have come over to North America.
Well, when they do that touring super series, he'll probably suit up with Russia for at least the two games in Ontario. We've got to look at him then, and so will his coaches. And maybe they'll, I mean, if he's filling the net, they'll want him. Let's put it that way.
So number two on our list for prospects and the number one winger in the system is Kailer Yamamoto. He's about the same age as Jesse Puljujärvi. They're about 4 months apart. And I guess both 20 years old this year heading into camp. And or Yamamoto will be 20, I guess, right, in September here. And
yeah.
And Puljujärvi just turned 20.
Yeah.
So, Bruce, it's you know, there's lots of woe is the Oilers about the wing solution, but they really do have two fine prospects here in Puljujärvi and Yamamoto to challenge for those jobs on the right side. They're going to, I guess, be battling Pontus Åberg and Ty Ratty and Tobias Reeder for the right wing jobs.
And Drake Kajula.
And what's not to like about Kailer Yamamoto, other than he had it looks like he went into a funk when he went back to junior for about a month. Mm-hmm. And as I guess the other thing would be, as great as he was in the preseason last year, when he in actual league play, he looked overmatched. He didn't look fast enough or big enough in his NHL games.
There were times, but
yes. Yeah. That said, you know, that was, he was 18 then, and I guess he was 19 then, but he just ripped it up once he got going in junior. He just totally ripped it up in the second half of the year. And he's smart. He's fast. He's good with the puck. He's an offensive dynamo. And don't bet against him, I guess, because the coach and the coaches and the players really seem to like him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He had... in his nine games, he had some very good results in the underlying stats categories, shot attempts and scoring chances as per, this is a natural stat trick version I'm talking about, shots from good locations, which is more auto-generated than yours are. They saw him as a top six, and he played the most with McDavid and Maroon. Basically, he played 2 hours even strength on the year, 1 hour with those two guys, and then a half hour with Nugent Hopkins and Lucic. So he really had the sort of top-end line mates, and first or second line for the most part.
And they were counting on him to take over from Eberle. Like, they thought he would be Eberle last year, mm-hmm. essentially, yep. Bruce. That's what the coach had in mind, I'm sure, out of training camp.
Well, when Eberle was 18, 19, he was back in junior, and that's where Yamamoto wound up. And, I mean, they both – there's a lot of similarities there. They were both picked right out of the exact same spot, number 22. And it's a very rare guy that goes from in the 20s. And, you know, you talk about – first-round picks jump into the NHL. Well, usually they're top five or top 10 picks, right? And it's not very often. I mean, once in a while, you get a David Pastrnak who comes along. And even he needed half a season in the AHL, you know, before he came up. And clearly, he's an exceptional talent. We can only hope that Yamamoto is that good. He's a wee little guy. But, you know, you look around the NHL and you see guys like Mitch Marner what's his name in Calgary there? Johnny, what's his name? Oh, yeah, that guy, Johnny Goodrow. And some of these guys are, you know, pretty tiny and yet pretty deadly players. And Tampa Bay has had a run of these guys for 15 years now since they took Marty St. Louis and gave him a shot. And there's room for the right tiny guy in the NHL. They can not just survive, but thrive in the NHL. And I'm hopeful that Kailer Yamamoto is going to be one of those guys.
I think that out of training camp, we'll see what happens. I think Puljujärvi was a decent NHL player last year, two-way player. Like, mm-hmm. not great. The Oilers didn't have much of anything on the wing going much, except for Maroon last year. And he kind of left on a sour note on a kind of a 10-game skid before he got traded.
Right.
But I think Puljujärvi definitely makes the team, and I think he should be I mean, if they're going to put Puljujärvi on the third line and tell him, okay, you carry the mail, you be the man, you build up your confidence, you carry the puck, I'm okay with that. I really think, though, he'd be great on a line with Dreisaitl and Rieder, mm-hmm. and I'd like to see that line. But Yamamoto could get on the top line. Not out of training camp, I don't think. I think he really should go and needs to go to Bakersfield based on what his results last year. Go to Bakersfield, dominate down there. See if you can dominate down there. It's not going to hurt you to go there for 2 months. If you can dominate there, get a point a game, there might be a spot for you on the top line if Ty Ratty doesn't pan out with McDavid and RNH. But let's see you first. Go to Bakersfield, kick butt down there. And the logical – that would be a logical step rather than investing too much in the player. I mean, Ty Ratty is good to go, I think. He finished out strong on that top line. I see no reason not to go with Ty Ratty unless – you know, unless Yamamoto's like scoring 2 goals a game in preseason.
I was gonna say, we have to give him the benefit of the preseason. If he comes in and blows everybody's doors off, you can't sort of just stick to some ideology that, oh, he's got to go to the minors. I mean, you got to give him a legitimate chance. But I my take on where the guy is and where he's got to be is he would benefit from half season, even. Like, I don't think he needs to be down there the whole year, but he maybe needs to spend a few weeks, couple months down there, is a probable outcome. And that said, like I say, if he comes in, he's clearly one of the top two right wingers in camp, then there's a spot in the top six for him.
Wouldn't that be great, Bruce, if both Puljujärvi and Yamamoto by the new year are flying on the top two lines on the wings, like playing like you know, they meet not just reasonable expectations, but every expectation, or they exceed expectations this year. If both of those players were to do that, I think personally Puljujärvi is a really good fit with Dreisaitl and Rieder. And if Yamamoto were to really step up and just seize the day as well, that would be exciting for the Oilers. And that's kind of the dream situation. You know, more likely one of the two will seize the day. We don't know which one of the two it's going to be. But I think one of the two is going to do it this year, and I'm looking forward to it. And both of them have they're such talented hockey players. So fingers crossed, man.
And it got like two more right-handed sticks along with our man, Kirill Maximov, that somewhere in there, we need to have somebody who develops that one timer off the left side on the power play. And chances are good, it will be one of those guys. Just by seniority, Puljujärvi's closest, then Yamamoto, then Maximov's probably a year away before they're looking at him in pro even. But there's at least there's some actual talented prospects on the vine and entering the pro ranks. We're starting to finally sweeten the pot down there after having a pretty lame collection of, you know, forward talent in Bakersfield. Like forwards, sure, and some of them may even be okay players, but you're talking about gifted forwards, it's been pretty thin on the vine down there.
Of course, the Oilers have traded away their best winger every season for the last 3 years, and Taylor Hall, Jordan Eberle, and not necessarily their best, and Patrick Maroon. So that's why there's a bit of an issue on the wing, and I would be remiss for not pointing that out, because a lot of fans are sitting there like, oh, these guys are that Staples, he's always so positive or optimistic, but man, Shirelli's dug a deep hole. And that is true. You know, Taylor Hall, Jordan Eberle, and Maroon are all sorely missed on the wing. And they now need either like this class of Ratty, Aberg, that kind of player to step up, Rieder, or they need one of these young guys to fulfill his potential this year. I think one of them might save Shirelli's bacon. One or two of them might just save Shirelli's bacon, Bruce. How about that? So,
well, somebody needs to.
or not, or his bacon won't get saved.
Well, that's the choice, yeah. But he's, I mean, some of these bets that he's made in young players are going to start paying off. Simple as that. So.
All righty. Well, we'll leave it there, and we'll talk about the defenseman. some of the defense. Well, I think we're going to break the defensemen into right and left defense.
We might have to. There's 11 bloody defensemen in the top 25.
There you go.
Seven righties. You want to talk about Shirelli? If there's one thing that he's fixed, and we'll talk about that next time, it's depth of prospect at right defense.
The rightorium. Yeah, you got the rightorium going on. All right, so I guess one of the rookies in town, man. When do they get?
Well, they're playing games on the 11th against the Nate and McEwen All-Stars, whatever that is, and then they're playing the Calgary Flames rookies in Red Deer on the 12th.
All right, so we'll be back. Hopefully we'll be back in the next day or two when Darnell Nurse signs, when and if Darnell Nurse signs. Yes, I know some people, I heard Frank Saravalli saying, like, you know, what's going on there? Why haven't they signed him yet? And Low Tide was telling us all to be patient today, and I'm in the Low Tide camp on this one. Like,
apparently he's coming. He's in town, or he's on his way to town today.
No, he's in town, Bruce. There was a picture of him on the ice in Edmonton with McDavid. So talk about his agent's probably thinking, why are you screwing our bargaining position by doing that? Although I don't think that makes any difference. But I think Nurse gives every indication of wanting to be ready to go and good to go at the start of the year and ready to sign.
Winnipeg signed Wheeler today. And that maybe now that sort of big deal is behind them, now they can turn their attention to Morrissey. And Morrissey's on that short list with Theodore, Nurse, and with Hanifin, who was the first of the four sort of defense free agents, restricted free agents to sign late last week. And I'm actually kind of surprised they didn't just go bam, 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 1, 2, 3, 4. But if Morrissey signs, and that's all the comparables you're going to need.
I hope that Jose Theodore, Bruce, gets every cent that he's worth. And I think he should wait till Christmas. Shea Theodore should wait until Christmas just to make sure he's getting every last dollar he can out of the Las Vegas Golden Knights or whatever they're called. And, you know, would that work for you too?
As long as it's him doing it and not Darnell Nurse in Edmonton, because, we got to get the team together and going here. This week. It's got to happen this week. Got to.
Okay, what day? What's your prediction?
Tomorrow, Wednesday. It's coming.
Okay. It's coming. Alrighty. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for talking.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.